It's just gone 3:30 and now on BBC Radio 4 in our next literary misfit story, a certain Mr. Gulliver inadvertently finds himself washed up on the shores of John Bull's other island in The Final Voyage of Gulliver. Readers of my famous Travels into Several Remote Nations of the World by Lemuel Gulliver, sometimes referred to merely as Gulliver's Travels, will know that it was in the land of the Houyhnhnms that I had my last great adventure. Those magnificent beasts created a wondrous world, the preserve of decency and civility in the highest degree, a world in which I had so long the honour to be an humble inhabitant. However, gentle reader, I have a confession to make. I did not take my final journey to the country of the Houyhnhnms, but to a land no less strange and mysterious than the other territories I visited. For the first time I feel able to finalize the account of my travels. This is that story. I had been at home in England for more than 5 years, and had only just become reaccustomed to the habits, smells, and sounds of human beings, the species called Yahoos by the wonderful Houyhnhnms. I could at last kiss my wife and children without revulsion. One day, however, I found myself at the Bristol dockside watching a ship, the Methuselah, being loaded with wool, tallow, and finished goods. A strange urge took over my spirit, and I felt a terrible longing for the sea and travel and maybe further adventure. I offered myself as ship's surgeon to the captain, a certain William Barnabas. He took me on gladly. The next day we were at sea, bound for the Caribbean. I soon regretted my decision. Barnabas spent his waking hours drinking claret wine, and within days we were lost. A great storm broke out. As the storm raged, we hit some rocks. The last thing I remember was falling overboard. The sun was shining when I returned to my senses. I was lying on a yellow beach with a quiet sea lapping at my feet and great green hills rising above my head. As I lay, letting the sun dry my clothes, I wondered where fate had cast me this time. Down a lonely path there appeared a sort of horse and cart driven by a ruddy-faced man dressed in the strange garb of a heavy tweed suit and a black, almost spherical hat. He appeared a gentleman, though clearly a peasant. "You'll be wanting a lift," he said. "And as sure as me name is Patsy Farrell, I'll provide it for you." "That would be very kind. A hotel or somewhere. Only cost you a couple of pence." "I can pay," I said, and held out 2 coins from my pouch. He took one in his hand and examined it. "Well, I've never seen anything like that. 17, 20, 1. A coin of great antiquity." "Oh, no," I replied. "These coins were freshly minted the week I left England." "Is that a fact? You've been travelling some time, then?" "What country is this?" I asked. "Well, I've heard it called many things," he said. "Kathleen O'Houlihan, the Emerald Isle. Some like that old Egypt George Bernard Shaw call it John Bull's other island." "Island? Oh, then I'm not too far from home." He looked at my clothes, so different from his, at my face and hair, at the coin in his hand. "It's a long way from home you are, I'd be thinking," he said. After exchanging a few words with his horse, a most intelligent animal, I joined him on the cart and we set off for a place called Roscullen, where, he informed me, the best hotel in Ireland was to be found. However, as we passed along a lane, we were met by a strange metallic monster, moving at a great speed of maybe 15 miles an hour, without the aid of horses or any other visible means of propulsion. I shook with terror and grabbed the sides of the cart as the monster sped past.
"Sure it's just one of those new-fangled motor cars," said Farrell.
"What day is it?" I asked.
"Thursday.
I mean, what date?"
"Why, it's Thursday, the 14th of July, 1904.
Strangely, this news did not shock me. I'd seen so many things that nothing was left of surprise for me. Somehow I had washed ashore in an island nearly 200 years into the future. As you will know, dear reader, Ireland is a benighted place riddled with popery and poverty, and I wanted to know how it now fared. Farrell left me at a bridge before Roscullen and suggested I get a proper pair of shoes without the buckles. I walked into the town, where I was met by two men I later discovered were Father Dempsey, a papish priest, and Larry Doyle, a civil engineer. I asked for directions to the hotel.
"Man alive, there's no hotel in Roscullen," said the priest.
"No hotel? Well, the driver told me there was the finest hotel in Ireland here.
Sure, he'd say whatever was the least trouble to himself, and the pleasantest to you, thinking you might give him a threepenny bit."
"Well, perhaps there's an inn," I said.
"A public house? Sure, there's 17, but they have no place to put you," said Doyle.
"That's an English accent," said the priest. "We've been expecting you. The new prospective Member of Parliament for Roscullen. Come with us. I know just an inn would suit you."
I denied I was that man, but the priest would have none of it and convinced himself I was travelling incognito. To test me out, he asked, "How would you improve the state of Ireland if you were the Member of Parliament, Mr. Gulliver, I said. I went along with the discussion. "We English must place our capacity for government at the service of nations who are less fortunately endowed in that respect, so as to allow them to develop in perfect and complete freedom to the English level of self-government," I said.
"That's the stuff," said Father Dempsey. "Freedom, that's what we want to hear in Roscullen. Oh, you're a man of the future, all right."
I continued, "It seems to me that an Englishman with no humbug about him, who will talk straight, enlightenment, common sense, must win his way with men of all classes." His associate, Mr. Doyle, looked at me strangely, however.
"Well, I've lived in London many years," he said, "but I've never seen anybody dressed like that."
"Well, it's the latest fashion," I said.
"Just how would you improve things here?" he asked.
"Well, the wretched condition of the country is in part due to the improvident and profligate poor. The remedy is wholly in our own hands. We must raise the people to equal England's efficiency in industry, then shake off the English yoke. Ireland can be a new Arcadia, and the Irish ought to be as free as their brethren in England. Were they not born as free? Does not the same sun shine upon them? Have they not the same God as protector?"
"You're a politician, all right," he said. "But you reckon without the Irish mind, the Irish climate. Wits can't thicken in that soft, moist air, on those white, springy roads, in those misty rushes and brown bogs. The dreaming. An Irishman's imagination never lets him alone, never satisfies him, so he can't face reality or deal with it or conquer it. If you want to interest him in Ireland, you've got to call the unfortunate island Kathleen O'Houlihan and pretend she's a little old woman. It saves thinking. It saves working." He looked at me and then went on. "Are you sure about those trousers?" "The stockings," I said. "3 guineas a pair." A very hard-headed man for an Irishman is Mr. Doyle, probably due to the time he spent in England. We went on to the public house. There I was treated to a fine supper. I spent the evening with the priest and several interested members of his congregation discussing the future of the country. One suggested that I should maybe get a haircut and a more contemporary jacket. Next day I slept late and decided to take a walk westward to a hillside of heather slopes, on which stood a round tower. Near the tower I came across a man engaged in the strange occupation of talking to grasshoppers. He introduced himself as Peter Keegan, ex-priest.
"The town is buzzing with the news of you, Mr. Gulliver," he said. "The conquering Englishman, Within 24 hours of your arrival you have carried off the hearts of the town and practically secured the parliamentary seat."
"I'm not convinced that the population here will accept an Englishman," I said.
"Oh, you will win the seat if you want it, with your dreams of efficiency in business, despite those stockings. 3 guineas, I'm told. But be careful, sir. Ireland, for good or evil, is like no place under heaven, and no man can touch its sod or breathe its air without becoming better or worse," he said.
"Dreams? These are not mere dreams," I said. Keegan was adamant.
"No doubt you will turn Ireland into a factory, or a garden, or a golf course, and our place of torment shall be as clean and orderly as the cleanest and most orderly place in the world," he said.
I replied, "Whoever makes 2 blades of grass grow upon a spot of ground where only 1 grew before, sir, deserves more from God than any idle man." Yeah, the English are busy people indeed, he said. But what sort of dream is that? A lifetime of toil? In my dreams, Ireland is a country where work is play and play is life. It is a temple in which the priest is the worshipper and the worshipper the worshipped. The day may come when these islands shall live by the quality of their men rather than by the abundance of their minerals. These are, of course, the dreams of a madman.
You are a dreamer, sir, shouted Mr. Doyle, who suddenly appeared at my shoulder.
Keegan went on, however. When I come here in the evenings to meditate on my madness and break my heart over the blinded soul of the Island of Saints, you will comfort me with the bustle of a great hotel and the sight of little children carrying the golf clubs of your tourists as a preparation for the life to come.
A practical and wealthy Ireland, shouted Doyle.
I shall wish you good evening, then, said Keegan. I am better alone at the Round Tower, dreaming of heaven. He turned and walked away.
Aye, that's it, shouted Doyle. There you are, dreaming, dreaming, dreaming. If you are going to be so sentimental about Ireland, then good evening to you too, sir.
He turned to me.
An Irishman's heart is only his imagination. Sentiment and nonsense. I've been thinking of what you said, Mr. Gulliver. You are the future, my friend. Now come with me. We are going to parade the prospective candidate for Roscullen through the town in my new motor car.
I'm from the year of our Lord, 1721, and I was the future?
The Irish, slow, sentimental and lazy as they are, will surely respond to your vision for the future and your dreams of prosperity for all, he said. I shall be the member, I cried. Lead the way, Mr. Doyle. It was a great parade. The whole town came out to see me. Someone placed Matty Haffigan's pig on my lap to please the crowd. Unfortunately, the pig was just as frightened of the motor car as I once was. It jumped out of the window and was hit head-on by the car and died immediately. The drunken mob roared with laughter, and a spit was set up to roast the poor animal on the spot. Knives and forks were handed out. I divined that this must be the end of my candidature, but Larry Doyle thought differently. If you were an Irishman, you'd be finished. But as you are an Englishman, they will laugh. And as they laugh, you will take the seat.
I purchased a proper bowler hat, 10 shillings and 6pence, and stood for election. Well, I've listened to every side of the argument. I've heard Doyle and Keegan. I've paid attention to the mob, the priests, the gentry, even to the beasts of the field. But I have to tell the truth. The Irish will never be rich or free. They haven't the energy, the craft, or the manners. These people will war with each other over the flimsiest of notions. Whether it will rain, which end of a boiled egg to crack open first, it will always be. 100 years from now, nothing will have changed. The dreams, the sentiment, the superstition will keep them in indigence. In the year 2004, it will be the same. That is their tragedy. But I think I'll stay. I don't miss my home. The people here look up to me, and I do what I can for the poor benighted souls. And anyway, there are multitudes of beautifully bred horses with whom I can converse on serious matters. If not exactly the Houyhnhnms, they are still wise, sober, and loyal. I am the sitting member for Roscullen. I have a fine house and several 100 acres with park, woodland, and arable land that provides nearly 6,000 a year. A healthy larder and all the sport I require. I ask you, gentle reader, what more could an honest Englishman want?
The final voyage of Gulliver was written by John Morrison, read by Mark Lambert, and produced in Belfast by Heather Brennan.